Aisha Hazarika on Times Radio.
Now, one issue which will dominate the next general election is the state of the NHS. And it's one of those topics that isn't just in the Westminster bubble. It affects each and every one of us. Now, waiting lists have gotten so bad that many of us are actually considering turning to private providers. It's something I've noticed from even my most lefty, pro-public service, right-on friends. It's something they have started admitting to, and they are not alone. Research by YouGov this week reveals that one in eight people in the UK have paid for private health services in the past year. The research found that another 27% had considered going private but had decided against it, often because they can't afford it. And the chief of Compare the Market, Mark Bailey, says that his website was seeing almost 100,000 people a month searching for private health insurance. That's a whopping 80% increase in the last 3 months. So something is definitely afoot. Now, there's two schools of thought about private healthcare. One, there is concerns that if you do start going private, you're going to create a two-tier system with the people who can't afford to go private getting stuck in the NHS with long waiting lists and understaffed hospitals. But then there's another school of thought saying, actually, does it help keep the NHS afloat if those who can afford private healthcare pay for their own services? Well, let's investigate what's happening. We've got a brilliant panel for you. We have the health writer and commentator Roy Lilly, who's in the studio with me. Hi, Roy.
Good afternoon.
And we have David Hare, Chief Executive of the Independent Healthcare Providers Network. Good evening, David.
Good evening.
Good evening. But first, I'd like to start off by speaking to somebody who is right at the centre of this story, Fiona Duppenbecker. Now, Fiona, you have got an interesting situation because you're in a situation where you are now kind of having to consider private healthcare. Tell us your story briefly.
Yeah, back in January, I was invited to what all the women in the UK will be over the age of 24, the cervical screening. It's a routine procedure, you know, you kind of get it over and done with and hope for the best. This time I got, I had it done in February and got a letter in March saying that I've got some abnormalities in the cells in my cervix that the NHS want to investigate further. But that was kind of it. Just was told that I would receive a letter with an appointment for the next step, which is called a colposcopy. So I've been waiting as patiently as possible, but obviously the letter itself says, you know, if left untreated, this can develop into cancer, which is quite a scary thing to read. And I've been waiting all this time. It's 5 weeks later, thinking, you know, any day now I'll get the letter for the appointment. And thought, you know, maybe I should chase it up. So I called my GP on Monday, just gone, who said it's not really up to them. They don't know what the situation is with the hospitals, but actually kindly gave me the number of the clinic that I would be eventually contacted by. So I took it upon myself to call the hospital and spoke to a really lovely lady who told me that they've got a massive backlog and that they are waiting for the clinics to open up in 8 weeks' time. So it's already been 8 weeks now since my screening. And then to think of waiting another eight weeks for the next step in that procedure really is just quite scary because, you know, it could be nothing. It could be that it's just, you know, the beginning stages and, you know, they can just really easily deal with it or tell me to, you know, keep an eye on it and come back next year, which, you know, I've had that before as well. But, you know, we all know how quickly things with cancer can get out of control, and that's quite scary. So the other day I thought, well, if it could be another 8 weeks or more, really, because, you know, those clinics start in 8 weeks' time, what's the private healthcare sector offering? And so I found a clinic up in central London that would be offering the procedure, like, potentially having a biopsy done as well, which often comes with the colposcopy. And that was going to be £940 just to, you know, get the initial step done, which I know when you think about, you know, your life and about cancer and stuff and knowing what could come further down the line feels like something maybe you just need to do. But it's just a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And thank you so much for sharing your story. I mean, I a while ago, a long time ago, about 10 years ago, I had a similar thing to you, and I had to have a colposcopy. And I got, you know, my doctor was very, very clear with me and said, you have to go and get this done, you know, really quickly for all the reasons you've said. So not only, you know, is it the money, but it must be a huge amount of worry for you as well. I mean, it really is. So what do you think you're going to, what do you think you'll do?
I think I'm going to look around at different providers. You know, like, I think there's so many gynecological clinics around London and stuff. So this was just an initial kind of figure that I found last week. You know, I've spoken to my mum about it. You know, what do we do? You know, could she kind of help me and stuff by potentially, you know, giving me the money for now, and then I can pay her back sort of in an installment plan or something like that, you know, which seems ridiculous when you're just trying to, you know, like, take care of your own health. But
and it's not an ideal situation, is it, to have to be having, you know, another loan from the bank of mum and dad? I mean, Well, look, Fiona, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's a really good example of the pressure that people are under, and really wish you well with whatever you decide to do. Do keep in touch with us and let us know how you're getting on. Right. I mean, Roy, I'm going to bring you in next. I mean, Fiona's case, listening to that, I mean, if that was me, I would be absolutely beside myself with worry. I had exactly the same thing as Fiona did. Luckily, that was at a time when there wasn't huge waiting lists. I got seen very, very quickly, and it was still very... I mean, is this a kind of common story? Are you hearing this more and more as a health commentator?
All the time.
Right.
All the time. It happens. It happens to me every day. And it's becoming more and more common. And of course, the problem is this. We have to kind of go back in time a little bit. And the NHS had about 10 years of flatline funding after the World Banking Crisis. Well, you forget all that. And that was when the real damage was done. We didn't train enough people, build enough hospitals, build enough beds, buy enough kit, scanners, all of that kind of stuff. And then, of course, along came COVID. And we forget that before COVID, the waiting list was £4.5 million. And 4.5 million people, 4.5 million people, and something like 40,000 vacancies and the nursing population. Of course, long comes COVID, all the bets are off, and then now we've ended up with 7.5 million. The NHS is trying to get back up on its feet. It's just had a pretty bad flu season, the remnants of COVID to deal with. And now we've got the strikes, and nearly 500,000 people have been knocked off the waiting list. And of course, the waiting list includes people who are waiting for scans, waiting for diagnostics, waiting in the same way that Fiona is waiting. And the whole thing is just getting worse.
So you're seeing a big spike in terms of, you know, what you're seeing as a health commentator, people going for this. And how is the sort of healthcare industry responding to this, the private health and insurance? I mean, is this great news for them, or is there so much kind of demand going to that side of things? Is that going to be difficult for them? Does it take pressure off the NHS?
Well, look, every operation that's done somewhere else other than the NHS is one less for the NHS to do. But the waiting lists are so huge, and the capacity of the private sector is really very small compared to what needs to be done. And so if people want to go private, that's fine. And they'll find a deal and someone will do it. Does it help? Well, not massively. I mean, it doesn't really make a huge dent in what happens. And in any event, most of the surgeons and the anaesthetists and what have you work during the day in the NHS, and they do their private work either in the evenings or at the weekends. And so, you know, it doesn't make that much of a difference, but it makes a huge difference to the individuals who get terribly worried.
I mean, if you're Fiona, right, you just want to get this done.
And what people haven't seen about Fiona, and we can see in the studio, is that she's a lovely young girl. You know, she could be my granddaughter or my daughter, and you look at her and you think, why in 2023, when we used to have one of the best healthcare systems in the world, why has it come to this?
Well, we are going to be exploring this in more depth. We've heard from Fiona, we've heard from Roy Lilly. We'll be hearing next from David Hare, who is from the Independent Healthcare Providers Network. It's just gone 6:46. You're listening to Weekend Drive on Times Radio with Aisha Hazarika.
Sunday morning with Kate McCann and Adam Bolton on Times Radio with RBC Bruin Dolphin. Make a good decision about what to listen to on Sunday mornings. Follow the smart advice and join Kate and Adam for all the latest news, incisive comment and expert opinion, plus in-depth analysis of the salient stories behind the week's headlines. Sunday morning with Kate McCann and Adam Bolton. Tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio with RBC Bruin Dolphin. Good decisions follow smart advice. Find out more at bruin.co.uk. This is Times Radio.
At Villa Plus, we've been matching people to their perfect villa holiday for over 30 years. So whether you want a romantic villa, plus a chance to reconnect, or a spacious villa, plus time to unwind, we're here to help with exclusive hand-picked villas, plus friendly in-resort teams. Book your perfect summer holiday now at villaplus.com. Villa Plus. It all adds up to amazing.
Is inflation bursting your retirement bubble? At RBC Brewin Dolphin, our advice is focused on putting wind back in sails, repairing burst bubbles, and steering your investment plans towards a more certain future. To speak to a financial advisor, search RBC Brewin Dolphin. Good decisions follow smart advice. Capital and any income from it is at risk.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio with Aisha Hazarika.
Welcome back to our final section of Weekend Drive. We're having a really interesting conversation looking into the rise of private health insurance. We just heard from Fiona, who really needs to get a colposcopy but is having to wait. She's now looking private. We've heard from the health commentator Roy Lilly, who rightly says, you know, what, it's pretty shameful that, you know, a young woman like Fiona's having to wait to get this really important diagnosis done. Let's now speak to somebody who's really, you know, at the heart of the private care provider section of society, David Hare. He's the chief executive of the Independent Healthcare Providers Network. David, welcome to the show. Are you seeing this huge uptick in people wanting to get private healthcare at the moment?
Yeah, we very much are, and it started really before the pandemic. Roy earlier mentioned the growing waiting list that was there before the pandemic, and that, you know, frankly, that we'd seen deterioration in NHS performance really over the course of the last 10 to 12 years. But undoubtedly, the pandemic has turbocharged that position. We now have a waiting list of 7.2 million. And I think, you know, the statistics are really, really powerful. You know, you've now got over 360,000 people waiting longer than a year for treatment. Pre-pandemic, that was around about 1,000 people. So, you know, those numbers have definitely increased. We're seeing, you know, growing numbers of people looking at their private options. Around about half the public now say they'd consider private healthcare if they needed it. And of course, that YouGov polling information from earlier in the week indicated just how many people are now accessing private treatment. Obviously, the focus is often on hospital treatment, but increasingly people are looking at their options for private general practice. Around a third of the public have now said they've actually accessed private general practice in the course of the last 3 years. So to a degree, there's a sort of normalisation of this going on. And it's, I think more and more people are looking at it.
And just explain as well, David, to my listeners, how, like, the costing structure works in the private sector. Do people pay on a monthly basis, or are people paying a sort of one-off fee for specific diagnosis or operations?
It will vary. And of course, people access private healthcare through different routes. So quite a lot of people, may access private healthcare through having private medical insurance. They may either take that out themselves or they'll have that through their employer. And we're certainly seeing growing numbers of employees, choosing their employer based on the offer of private medical insurance. Indeed, two of the private medical insurers, Aviva and Vitality, have reported significant increases in the number of insured lives taken out. But of course, lots of people, like Fiona, are considering, paying out of pocket for treatment. Some will pay for that, as a one-off block. Their providers will often allow you to stagger those payments over a period of time. And just to pick up on Fiona's point around shopping around, I would really strongly encourage that, because I think it's important that there are a range of providers out there. Prices will vary to an extent, and having a look at your options and getting the best deal for you, like with any other industry, is clearly important here.
And Roy's keen to come in. I'll bring him in just a moment. But a question that has come up from a couple of our listeners is just the cost of all of this. Because if private healthcare as an alternative was very affordable to people, many people, I think, would want to do it. But there are stories about the fact that it is, you know, people are putting up their prices. I heard someone doing on a phone-in show the other day saying they originally were seeing their private GP for 100 quid, 150 quid a pop. Now it's gone up to £400 for an appointment. I mean, is there a way of private healthcare being affordable for people?
I think I come back to that point around shopping around. You know, the figure that you put on that is way, the £400 is well above the numbers that I would see for a private GP procedure. Clearly, it will vary because, you know, the cost will, you know, depend on the amount of time perhaps the patient has with the individual and so on. But I think, you know, interestingly, the YouGov survey from Monday of this week indicated the average spend that people were paying on private healthcare was £500. Now, you know, I wouldn't want to suggest in any way that that's not an insignificant sum of money. But, you know, for a lot of people, that is perhaps affordable. And healthcare is something that people really value. And if they are struggling to get access to the NHS, which we know many people are at the moment, then they will look to prioritise that spend to access to access private healthcare.
Roy?
Yeah, there were a couple of things, really. Something David said about GPs, and I'll come back to that. But just thinking about Fiona again for a moment. I mean, she was looking to pay for a diagnostic. Once she's got the diagnostic, what happens then? Let's say the worst is happening and something sinister needs to be attended to. She still has to get back in the NHS for an operation. And I tell you what will happen. She'll be on the waiting list. The surgeon, the first thing the surgeon will say before he operates on her is, let's have a look at a diagnostic. And they'll do it all again because they'll need the latest diagnostic. On the point that David made about GPs, I think this is very important. I cast my mind back to when Virginia Bottomley was the Secretary of State for Health, and she had a spat with a dentist. And she said they were drilling for gold at the time, and they were paid for what they did. She wanted to change the contract. She changed the contract, and what happened? The dentist walked, and within 3 months, a small company called Denplan had suddenly blossomed into a huge organisation. What I'm worried about and what I can see happening is the same thing happening with GPs. I think a lot of GPs are coming to the end of their tether and the end of their time in the NHS. They'll still be on the GMC register, and we will see more and more GPs setting up in private practice. You can do it now with the video services that are online, which are relatively cheap. And we're going to see more and more GPs, I think, migrate away from the NHS and set up private practice. At the moment, it's distributed mainly around London and the big conurbations. But I think we're going to see more of that, as some of these GPs who are very experienced and the NHS can't afford to lose them. So they'll just say, you know what, I can set up shop myself.
David, we've got a few messages coming in, and again, a lot of people are coming back to the point that, you know, they would like to look into it, but they just can't afford it. I mean, I myself had to go private recently around menopause healthcare, and it was not cheap, as you say. I mean, it was a very good service, I can't fault it, but I had an appointment, a blood test, and 3 months of medication, and it was well over £500, which is a lot of, I mean, you know, it's a lot of money for me. It's certainly a lot of money for people who are struggling, you know, with the cost of living crisis. Do you think if more people need private medicine, then the costs could come down eventually?
I think, you know, healthcare is expensive. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I think, you know, when we look at the NHS, you know, we see it as a free service. It's actually a free at the point of use service, which is funded through general taxation. And of course, the cost for a lot of those procedures is is inevitably expensive. Now, it will vary. You know, the cost of healthcare will vary. It's quite different from having a general practice intervention or possibly a scan to having, say, a hip operation done. You know, those costs do vary. I think, you know, anyone considering it, I would strongly encourage them to shop around, make use of information such as the Private Healthcare Information Network, which gives information on hospitals, on consultant performance, and indeed on cost as well. I think that's something that people should strongly consider. And inevitably, there'll be a degree of competition here that will maintain costs. But fundamentally, you know, it is a relatively expensive commodity to purchase. There's no getting away from that.
I mean, I think David's right. I mean, hitherto, I think private healthcare has been the preserve of the rich and the knowing. You know, how do you do it? How do you get private healthcare? I think now that will change. I think it will become much more transparent. I think demand will drive a market. We will see probably price lists published for simple procedures, and people will understand what they're getting into. Because at the moment, I think a lot of people don't do it because they're frightened of what it's going to cost and they don't bother. But a lot of people, a lot of families, I find, are now syndicating the cost of a treatment. Granny needs a new hip. Everybody puts, you know, 500 quid on their Barclay card.
Kind of crowdfunding granny's hip.
Exactly. And that's what's happening, because I'm sure David will confirm that the actual self-pay sector of his market is absolutely blossoming.
Is that true, David?
Yes, I mean, as I indicated previously, really two ways into private healthcare, mainly one through insurance, one through self-pay. Self-pay has definitely seen the biggest growth of those two over the course of the last 2 years. Indeed, numbers up 32% on pre-pandemic, hip operations up 152%, knees at 123% up. So, those people, you know, the number of people self-funding their own treatment. Interestingly, the two jurisdictions or two parts of the United Kingdom where the growth is highest is Scotland and Wales, which is interesting, but there is growth across the...
Interesting. Okay, we're just reaching the end of our time. Roy, very quickly, I've got two questions I want to put to you, so briefly, if you could.
Yeah.
First question, a couple of people have messaged and saying, has this been deliberately done, running down the NHS to move us to private health? Is this some sinister plot to make the country basically give up on the NHS?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just inept government and a series of catastrophes that we probably didn't see coming. But it's fundamentally the damage was done after the World Banking Crisis, where the policy was then to cut back on public expenditure.
And then if more people do go private, does this fundamentally weaken the NHS? Does this create a two-tier system?
Not at the moment. I don't think there's enough people to damage it. But over the longer run, it undermines the confidence in the NHS. And we start... saying, well, we could go private, do we need an NHS? That's when you're in danger then of having a poor service for poor people.
And then final question, we know that there's another big row brewing between the nurses and the health secretary. The health secretary is actually thinking of taking the nurses to court over their next set of industrial action. Your reaction to that?
Well, on a week really that's been symbolised by bullying in government, isn't it great that the Secretary of State is going to bully the nurses and take them to court over a strike, which is perfectly legal for them to do? It kind of says it all we need to know about how the country's being run.
And what about the standoff with the BME? You know, the government saying 35% is just too much. I mean, do you think the BME should say, look, fine, we're going to reduce that offer and let's get around the table?
Yeah, I think both sides should say, let's have talks without preconditions. Don't abandon the 35%, don't abandon anything else, but let's talk and see where it gets us.
Well, what a fascinating discussion. I feel I've learned a lot there. Really, really interesting topic. Lots of you messaging in about that, and something that I think we're definitely going to see more of. My huge thanks to Roy Lilly, to David Hare, and to Fiona Dupin-Pecker, and I hope she does get some good results. That's all from me. I'll be back tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Thank you to my brilliant team, Kia, Emily, James, and Marnie. I will be back with you tomorrow. Next up, it's Mariella Frostrop's Cultural Week here on Times Radio. Enjoy.